If it's Friday, it's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. On this edition, Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Lyndon Nave talk about the plants in your life that you want to grow or grow better. We'll also cover growing local foods, local food organizations, and high tunnel vegetable and fruit production. Call in with your questions at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and the conversation takes root just after the news. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander, and we're talking plants with Extension horticulturists Richard Giron and Lyndon Nave. They'll take your questions about anything you want to grow or grow better. Call in at 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Hello, Richard and Linda. How are you today?
Good morning.
Good morning. Good. Thanks, Julie.
Good. I'm glad. Well, there's several topics we'd like to cover, but we just heard in the news that there may be a frost. What plants are most susceptible to frost at this time, and what should people do exactly? Are there little blankets you can get to cover?
Well, you can use blankets or sheets.
Really?
But,
okay.
I think the vast majority of plants will be okay as far as, for example, your perennials. Your peonies, your irises, your daylilies, they can typically tolerate a light freeze, so they'll be okay. The trees and shrubs should be okay. They might suffer some minor damage, should be okay. The biggest concerns would be for things like fruit trees, like your apples and your pears, especially in northern Iowa. Those plants have already bloomed, and if we have freezing temperatures, that could damage the developing fruit and cause those fruit to basically abort and fall off. So that could drastically affect the yield of like apples and pears if we do have freezing temperatures. Mm-hmm. If you have strawberries and if they're blooming and then you have a freezing temperature, that could damage the actual flower buds and reduce the crop also on those. Now, what you could do in that situation, you could go out and maybe cover the strawberry patch with some straw or maybe some light blankets or sheets, and that should protect them. And then you can remove that in a couple days, and they'll be just fine. Cool season vegetables, things like lettuce, spinach, radishes, carrots, beets, onions, they'll be fine. No need to cover those. If you have some warm season things in the garden, like tomatoes and peppers, and if a frost is forecast for your area, then I would cover those because they are not frost tolerant. Mm. So cover those with maybe a box or a big pot or something, and that should provide some protection.
Okay, that sounds good. Glad to know that. Callers, call in at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org if you have horticulture questions today for Richard Giron or Linda Nave. High tunnel vegetable and fruit production. We mentioned that in the introduction. Linda, remind us what that is about and give us some details.
Well, it's interesting. We just heard Dave Swenson's report on local foods, and that's a great lead-in to this because growers around the state are putting up high tunnels to extend their seasons so that they're able to provide more locally available fruits and vegetables locally produced. So it all kind of ties together. And the Natural Soil Conservation Service, NRCS, had a pilot program going this year, first year of three, in which 38 states are participating. And this is the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food initiative, in which the USDA, through the NRCS, is helping support the construction of high tunnels. So we have more local food production for a longer season. And these high tunnels are very simple greenhouse-like structures. They're the ribbing, the steel hoops with a plastic covering on them. They're passively ventilated. so that the sides roll up, the ends open up on hot days, and they can go down on cool evenings like we're anticipating here. Mm-hmm. And this last year in Iowa, not all counties participating, but in Iowa, the NRCS funded 61 high tunnels, and so that we 65 high tunnels with 31 contracts still out there. So there might be even more going up yet this year. And what they're growing in those is anything from lettuce and spinach. Some people are putting onions in them. A vast majority are putting in warm season crops such as tomatoes, peppers, green beans, cucumbers, those high value items that they can get on the market very early, either for farmers markets, for CSAs, for wholesale sources such as grocery stores, restaurants, schools. So they're really extending their season in the spring of several weeks and again in the fall several weeks, so they can be growing your cool season crops clear up past Thanksgiving. So we'll have a good supply of our locally produced foods. So it's an exciting program. The NRCS is the key agency in which they're funded, and they will look at conservation practices associated with high tunnels, the reduced impact on the environment, water quality, etc. So it's a great program. I think we're going to see a lot coming from it.
Okay, and where can people get more information?
They can get more information by contacting their local local NRCS office, or by contacting us here at Iowa State University, or going online to the Leopold website.
Okay, sounds good. We'll go to our first caller here. I'm Marty in Iowa City. Welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. What's your question?
Oh, my question is about corn gluten. And I know that Iowa State has been very involved in the creation of this pre-emergent kind of mulch. And I bought a big 50-pound bag, in a paper bag, and put it on my not-closed-in back deck. And some animal got in and just ripped the bag, this big hole in it, and it was thrown all around the deck. And then the little dog, neighbor dog, seems to like it too, and she eats it. I'm wondering if that will be sort of an attractive thing about my garden if I put that gluten on. I've waited till I could call you guys.
Remind us what this is exactly.
Well, corn gluten meal is a corn milling byproduct. And they have found that corn gluten meal will inhibit the germination of seed, and specifically weed seed in the garden. And so you can apply this to the lawn as a pre-emergent herbicide to prevent crabgrass. You can apply it to your vegetable garden, your fruit garden, and that may prevent some of the weed seed germination there too. So it's basically a pre-emergent. It also does contain nitrogen, so it also acts as a fertilizer. There's about 10% nitrogen in the corn gluten meal. So you get both things. You get a pre-emergent herbicide, and you get the fertilizer. It's most effective in a lawn situation, not as effective in a garden situation, but it's still useful, still helpful. As far as in the garden, I would still go ahead and use it. You're not going to apply that much over a garden area, so it's not going to, I don't think, attract any type of animal in the garden.
Good. That's It gives me an answer, because I didn't want to put it all over the garden and then have all the raccoons in the area come.
No, that shouldn't be a problem. Now, realize that it may prevent the germination of some weed seed, but not all. You'll still have to go out there periodically and maybe hoe and hand pull, but it may prevent some weed seed germination.
And also, it's kind of an over time thing. It won't be as effective the first year, but if you use it the second year and the third year, you have greater effectiveness out of the corn gluten meal. So it's not, don't expect miracles the first year. It's kind of a persistent sort of thing. You've got to continue to use it.
Well, like everything that I've learned about gardening, is I don't expect miracles at all, especially weeding type ones.
That's a good attitude to have.
Thanks.
So, I can feel that I can just go out and put some on, and I won't be attracting a zoo.
Okay. That's the way it looks at this point, Marty. Thanks for calling.
Sure. Thank you. And your program is wonderful.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. Good luck. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
If you'd like to call in to ask Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron and Linda Nava a question about the plants in your life, call in at 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. Or you can email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we do have an email from Kay. I'm not sure where they're calling from, but or emailed from, but they say you may have already addressed this on an earlier program, but please advise again how to discourage groundhogs from getting into my raised bed gardens.
That's a little bit out of my area.
Yeah, I was wondering.
So that would be more
the animal
ecologist, Jim Pease.
Right.
I think he still does the program on occasion.
Right,
so.
Tuesdays every month. But okay, we just thought we... you'd weigh in on that, but okay, we'll move on, and hopefully they can get to Jim Pease on that question. The other topics we were going to cover today include growing local foods. I know you touched on that a bit with the high tunnel food production, but what more can we, what are some of the other bits of information on growing local foods and local food organizations?
There are a number of local food organizations, Julie, around the state that are working as nonprofits to enhance more growers and to get build greater awareness on local foods. And some of those are the Buy Fresh, Buy Local chapters in your area. There are a number of those. And if you just go on to the Buy Fresh, Buy Local website, mm-hmm. you'll be able to find some in your area. And then what they do is they list some of the growers that are producing specific crops. So that's a great one. And then Hometown Harvest is another organization that's working to promote local food production. Northeast Iowa Farm and Food Initiative is an excellent example of how communities are working together to build local food systems as well as build fitness opportunities to balance that food and fitness to prevent childhood obesity and just a lot of wonderful things going on. So there are many organizations out there in your local community, and many of the RC&Ds around are working on local food systems. So it's just really becoming very popular and a very good thing.
Okay. We'll go to another caller here. Well, after the break, obviously. But we'll get to the calls that we have, and one of them could be yours at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're taking a very short break. Richard Geron and Linda Nave will be here when we return. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander, and Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron and Linda Nave are here to take your questions about plants that you want to grow or grow better. 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll go to Dave in Wayne County. Dave, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Thank you very much. I was hoping the entomologist would be on today.
Last week.
When I come in from my garden spot, I drive in, and every time I go out, I end up with those nasty little arachnids on me, those ticks. And I pick them off and throw them out the window, but sometimes they end up down in the floor of the car and down in the floor of the truck. And my problem is if my wife gets in my truck and she suddenly has a tick crawling up her leg, she'll make me sell the farm. But my question is, how long can they live in that environment?
You all want to take a stab at that?
Not really, no.
Okay.
If you need to, you can call Donald at his office. His phone number here is 515-294-1101. So 294-1101.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling, Dave. Good luck. Hope you get an answer to that one.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye now. We'll go next to Tony in Cedar Rapids. Tony, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I have a neighbor that's got a whole bunch of wild violets. I call them wild violets. Mm-hmm. They took over her yard, and they're trying to creep into mine. And I'm just wanting to know if there's anything short of destroying my whole yard that can get rid of them.
Well, you basically have two options. You can dig them up with some type of trowel, whatever. That's an option. You can also use a broadleaf herbicide. And typically you want to use something, for example, that may contain triclopyr. It's a fairly common compound in many of the broadleaf herbicides, but it's TR.
And what was that again?
It's triclopyr.
Triclopyr.
TRICLOPYR. So look for that as an active ingredient in your broadleaf herbicide. Do use a spray, and you'll probably have to spray more than once. You'll probably have to spray a couple of times. The best times to do that are in the spring when they're blooming, and also in the fall. So those two times.
Okay.
So you do have those two options. You can physically dig them up. They don't really have a deep taproot like a dandelion does, so you can actually dig them up or use a broadleaf herbicide.
All right. I've got one more question, if you could, and that is I've got two hydrangea bushes. Mm-hmm. They're a lace cap is what they're called. I don't know what the generic name for them is outside of hydrangea bushes. And I've had them in the ground for approximately 3 years now, and they've never bloomed for me. I've talked to different people, and they said, well, it's going to bloom on old stock. So last year I just went out and covered them with leaves all the way up, probably about 2 or 3 foot of leaves around the whole bush. I took them apart this year, and all I got is dead stems. The greenery is coming up from the bottom again. Is there any way that, can you tell me what kind of a problem I got, I guess?
Well, there are different species or different types of hydrangea. The ones that we grow the most successfully are the white ones, like the Annabelles and the Grandiflora, the PG. And they bloom on new growth. The ones that we have a hard time with are those types that bloom on the previous year's growth. And what typically happens here in Iowa on the latter part is that many of these that bloom on last year's growth, oftentimes they don't survive the winter very well, and so they die back to the ground. And if they die back to the ground, all the old growth is destroyed and they don't bloom. They come back from the base and they really grow well and they have these very attractive leaves, but they don't bloom. So if you have a type that blooms on the previous year's growth and it's winter killing every year, you really can't do much. You could try basically putting a chicken wire fence around the plant in the fall and then filling that with straw or other material and hopefully protect it. But if you can't do that, then you really don't have a very good option. So,
Well, then, I mean, the greenery looks pretty.
Right.
There's no doubt about that.
But you really grow them for the flowers. So if they're not producing flowers, they're not as attractive, obviously. Mm-hmm. Now, the last two winters have been fairly cold winters. Mm-hmm. And so they may actually survive the winter fairly well if we have a mild winter. But I think that's going to be the exception rather than the rule. So in the future, it might bloom after a mild winter, but I think it's going to be every so often, not every year, obviously.
Okay. If I was to dig them up and put them on, my house faces south, and I've got early bloomers on the south side of my house. Would that be an option to put them on the south side of my house and see if that would help?
I don't think that's going to really help that much in that the key there is the minimum winter temperature. And even being on the south side, when the sun sets, it's still going to get very, very cold at night. So I really don't think it's going to provide much in the way of a benefit. So
okay.
Probably not.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you very much. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tony. I appreciate the call.
You bet.
Bye-bye now. Good luck. You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and we're talking with Richard Giron and Linda Nave. I'll take your questions at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I'm having some technical difficulty here connecting with some of the other callers. So while we're working on that, I wanted to ask you about mushroom season, actually. I've heard that the season is not as good as it used to be or has been in the past. Do you hear that? What's your pulse on mushrooming at this point?
I don't have much of a pulse on
that. I just thought I'd ask.
The only pulse we get is not a technical pulse. Let's put it that way. It's what we hear from hobbyists that go out and go mushroom hunting. And what I hear is that it's later and it's not as good. But that's just what I've heard.
And I've heard nothing, so.
Oh, okay.
That's about it. So that's, we don't really have a hotline that you could call. It's too bad, but, you know, it's kind of one of those, it's a fall foliage sort of thing that you just have to listen and hear and see what's going on. But from what I hear, it's been a little slower to catch on this spring for some reason, I don't know. And those that are hunting just aren't seem to finding as many as they have in the past. But that could be just a regional thing, but. It's interesting.
Okay. Well, just thought I'd throw that out there since I had heard. We have a caller on the line. I can't get to her right now. It's Irene from Powersville, Missouri. So I'm going to take the liberty, Irene, to ask her question. What would cause tulips to change color? You know, and I've heard this. My neighbor next door thinks her tulips were red last year and they're now white. So is this true? Is this what goes on?
Well, it's not very likely. Flower color is a genetic trait. And once you plant something, it's going to remain that way. Now, every once in a while, you might have a mutation or something like that where something can change. But those events are very, very rare. They don't happen very often. I think what may happen in many cases is that you might plant, let's say, some red ones and some yellow ones or maybe two or three different varieties. And one variety may decline very quickly. And the other variety may be more vigorous, so it hangs around. So maybe in 3 or 4 years, all you have left are maybe the yellow ones, and maybe the red ones have basically declined and died. And maybe you might then think that maybe the yellow ones are multiplying, or maybe the red ones changed to yellow when they really didn't.
Mm.
So plants typically don't change flower color very, very often. Sometimes you hear that as far as a peony changing color, or a lily changing color, or a tulip changing color. And really, that doesn't happen very often at all. So not likely.
Okay. We're going to be going into a break here. You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. And when we come back, hopefully, we'll be about 5 minutes. Hopefully, we'll have those callers coming in. I think we will. When we come back, Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Linda Nave will be here to answer your questions. 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Tainted over-the-counter drugs for children. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Some consumer advocates say more oversight is needed on over-the-counter drugs. Rebecca Williams reports the concerns come after recent recalls of infants and children's Tylenol and other medicines.
McNeil Consumer Healthcare recalled more than 40 different varieties of medicine for babies and kids. That happened only after inspectors from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration found major problems at a plant in Pennsylvania. Inspectors found raw ingredients were contaminated with bacteria. They also found the company did not have adequate lab facilities to test the drugs. And they found the company did nothing after complaints from consumers who found dark specks in liquid Tylenol products. Larry McNeely is with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. He says there are not enough government inspectors keeping an eye on the pharmaceutical industry.
We need more of those inspectors, and I think we were just lucky in some ways dodged the bullet because we were able to stop this before somebody got hurt.
The FDA says you should stop using all of the recalled products, but the agency says generic versions of these drugs are safe. For the Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
On the Alabama Gulf Coast, environmentalist volunteers have been throwing everything on the shore above the high water line so it's not hit by the oil spill. That is, they were doing that until they learned certain birds were nesting there. Now they're trying to get nests back onto the dunes so they're not disturbed. This is the Environment Report. There's this invasive plant that's practically taking over the forest in the eastern half of the country. It could cause some long-term damage. It's the time of year when garlic mustard starts popping up again, so we thought we'd revisit a story. Julie Grant took a walk with a guy named Brad Steeman through a park where the entire forest floor was carpeted with garlic mustard, thousands of them.
Steeman calls it the evil weed. Its triangle-shaped leaves shade out wildflowers so they don't grow. Even worse, Steeman says, garlic mustard poisons baby trees.
Once those large trees start dying off, there's nothing to replace them. And that's now is the greatest threat to our eastern forest.
Steeman says every year garlic mustard is spreading farther into the woods.
So here's a big stand of it. This is a healthy stand. So we should probably pull some. I'll pull some. You don't have to pull it.
And thank goodness he's doing it. That looks like tedious work. Steeman crouches down and starts pulling them out of the ground, roots and all. So far this season, he's filled 35 big garbage bags with garlic mustard plants. All along the eastern half of the U.S. and Canada, people are pulling up garlic mustard from parks and just throwing it away.
All these people are very short-sighted when they're doing that.
Peter Gale is a specialist in edible weeds.
They're not looking for other alternative uses, creative ways to use these plants that would be profitable.
Gale says, if you can't beat them, eat them. People brought garlic mustard to the U.S. in the mid-1800s because they liked it to eat.
This is a garlic mustard ricotta dip, garlic mustard salsa. Here's stuffed garlic mustard leaves, egg dishes.
Garlic mustard seeds taste like mustard, the leaves taste like garlic, and the roots are reminiscent of horseradish. Gale says people should go after garlic mustard in the parks, but then they should take it to farm markets to sell.
The best way to demoralize weeds is to eat them.
Today, Gale decides to blend a pesto using the early spring leaves. He picks every last garlic mustard in his yard to make a batch.
Well, there it is. That's garlic mustard pesto. And it isn't bad, is it?
It's delicious.
It does a good job. All right. I'll use that on ravioli tonight.
That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day, and we're talking with Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Linda Knave, and we're taking your questions at 1-866-780-9100. Or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I think we're going to go to our first caller here. Connor from Clinton is on the line. Hi.
Good morning. Good evening. Or good morning.
Yeah, okay.
Hi.
Whatever, wherever you are.
we're trying to grow some broccoli for the first time this year, and we grew them from seeds, and they're in our raised bed, but I've already noticed that the leaves are getting eaten away, and I don't see any worms, just some little black specks. This is going to be destined for our table for our kids, so I'm worried about pesticides and things. What would be the best way to treat that?
Well, depends on what you have. I have not seen any signs of cabbage loopers or cabbage butterflies out there, those white harbingers of spring, so to speak. Have you seen many of those flying around?
No, I haven't. You mean little small butterflies? No, I haven't seen any of that.
Yeah, because usually it's the adult butterfly that will lay her eggs on the broccoli, and then what emerges from there are these little green caterpillars, and the imported cabbage worms are the white butterflies, the cabbage loopers, and indescript moth. But anyway, then they start chewing holes, and you can usually see those caterpillars as they're doing the damage. So it could be something else causing those holes. which you've got to pretty much determine what it is before you can apply anything. The best thing to do is just go out and inspect the plants. If you're afraid to put any pesticides on and you don't have many plants, if you see the culprit, you can hand pick it. But until you really identify what's causing that problem, it's hard to say what you should be doing, except maybe going out and hand picking and inspecting the plants. And typically, if it's just the foliage on broccoli that's being consumed a little bit, the plant can tolerate a bit of damage, but it's the head that you want to control the pest problems on, because you don't want, you know, caterpillars in the head of broccoli, and et cetera. So I wouldn't be too concerned unless they totally defoliate or are really causing a lot of holes and problems, but it's that head that you're focused on.
So are you seeing holes in the foliage?
Yeah, there's no head developed really yet. The plants just have three or four leaves each at this point.
But they have holes in the foliage. Because a rabbit might munch on those, but they would not create holes in the foliage. They would eat at the margin. Okay. So if you're seeing holes in the foliage and some small black things on the foliage, those might be feces of the insect feeding on the foliage. Mm-hmm. So I would check very closely for those caterpillars.
Okay.
Does that answer it, Connor?
That's more than I knew beforehand.
Okay. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. We'll go next to Eric in Rock Island. Eric, welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. What's your question? Hello? Eric, are you with us? Well, maybe he'll call back. Why don't we go on to Don in Cedar Rapids. Don, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You were describing the issue on hydrangeas with growth on old or flowering on old growth. And I have two questions. One is we have a climbing hydrangea on a cottonwood tree that's probably up to about 12 or 13 feet now. And then I also have an oak leaf hydrangea, which obviously blooms on old growth. Are either of those viable plants in Iowa? And I think we've had some minor blooming with the climbing hydrangea, but not such good luck with the oak leaf.
We can typically grow those fairly well in central and southern Iowa. I would say they would be iffy for northern Iowa as far as getting them to bloom. But in central and southern Iowa, they should be okay.
Okay, well, we're Cedar Rapids.
Right.
But the oak leaf is on the sort of a northwest side of the house, gets very little sun. Is that a problem? And we've had a little trouble keeping it healthy.
It might be maybe an issue of insufficient light. That plant probably would prefer, let's say, maybe 4 or 5, 6 hours of sunlight to really do well. So not complete shade. So if it's receiving, let's say, less than 2 hours of sunlight, it may be a light issue, possibly.
Okay, I would think that's probably, I doubt if it gets even that much because of the house being tilted at an angle to the northwest. Is there any way then to help it with the low light, or is it just a sort of a lost cause?
Well, if it's not too big, you might consider moving it to a more favorable site. I would say a good site for that typically would be like an eastern exposure.
Okay.
Where it gets morning sun, afternoon shade, maybe 4 or 5 hours of morning sun might be a better place for it. And an eastern exposure would be also more protected.
Yes.
In the wintertime, too.
Well, just around the corner would make it to the southeast, to the northeast, and with the morning sun, I would probably get 5 hours of sun if I would move it around the corner. So.
And if you decide to move it early spring before it begins to leaf out would be a good time.
Okay. Before I do that, would it be okay to prune it down pretty substantially, or should I leave the growth?
I think what I'd probably do if it's a fairly big plant is maybe go out with some twine and tie it onto a stem near the ground and then kind of wrap it around as you go up on the plant and kind of make it smaller in size so you can work around it and dig it up and still keep most of the branches intact.
Okay.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Well, thanks, Don. Good luck with the hydrangea. We'll go next to Jeff in Waverly. Jeff, welcome to the program. What's your question for Richard Geron and Linda Nave today? Jeff? Well, maybe Jeff left as well. All right, we'll move on to Tony in Des Moines. Tony, welcome to Horticulture Day.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question? Hi.
I planted
some beans, peas, and squash about 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And was it too early? Because they haven't come up yet.
Yes.
And, well, I have to replant.
Where did you say you're from?
Des Moines.
Des Moines. Basically, yes, you're a little bit early, and the cool soil temperatures are the factor we're seeing there probably. And give them time. If I would definitely go out and in the row where you planted them, just dig down. Be curious. Dig down. See if you're seeing any signs of germination. They just might be sitting there waiting for the right moment to warm up and to come out. But actually, that was probably a blessing if they haven't come out already, because it's just a little chilly for beans right now. And if you planted them 2 weeks ago, I would definitely expect something coming up by now. But so I'd go out and dig down in, see what's coming up. Maybe the cool, moist temperatures could have rotted the seed. You never know. So I would go out, do some investigation. If you find no signs of life or any sprouting under the soil surface, I might consider replanting.
Okay. Also, I bought a tomatillo plant
mm-hmm.
at the garden center, and it has like little tiny buds of tomatillos on it. Do I have to cut those off before I plant them?
No. Tomatillos are fun little plants to grow. They're like a little husk tomato, and they'll grow fairly bushy, 2 foot wide to 3 foot wide, maybe 2 to 3 foot tall, and masses of production. If they've got buds on now, just leave them on. They'll grow out. They'll produce a number of tomatillos for you, but I would not do any pruning or pinching those off.
Okay.
Thanks, Tony.
Thanks for the help.
Yeah, good luck. We appreciate the call. We'll go next to Bill in Mason City. Welcome to Horticulture Day. Bill, what's your question?
Yeah, good morning. I have a plot of soil that I'm wanting to plant some wildflowers on. It originally was covered with blackberries and ash trees and elm trees. I cut down the elms and the ash trees and the hackback, the blackberries. They are now trying to volunteer coming up again. I want to put something down to get rid of those volunteer blackberries and the sprouts and the stumps and cover it with 1 to 2 feet of black soil and plant some wildflowers. And I'm not a big fan of herbicides, that will apply them if we can come up with something that's safe.
Well, you can dig them up. That would be one option, is simply dig up those volunteer plants. That's one definite option. The other option basically would be to cut them off and apply Roundup to the cut surface. So those would be the two most viable options.
Will the Roundup take care of the sprouting elm tree as well?
It should. I mean, you cut them off and then you apply the Roundup directly to the cut surface. The Roundup, the glyphosate, is a systemic product. It then travels down into the root system and kills the root system. And once you have the root system destroyed, that's it.
Yeah, and is Roundup fairly safe? Is it dissipates fairly rapidly?
It is very useful in that you can kill things, and then within a short time you can replant very, very nicely.
Okay.
Without any
that's
problems.
Helpful. I appreciate your help.
Thanks, Bill. Good
Thank
luck.
You. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll go next to Shaker in Ames. Welcome to Horticulture Day.
Hi. Good
Hi.
Morning.
Hi. Hope I got your name right.
Yes, you did. It's
okay.
Spelled differently, but you got the name right. I've just planted a barley cherry tree. And the question is, it's come on a different rootstock. It looks like it's grafted on a different rootstock. Now, if in the future I want the original root system to grow, how would I proceed with that? Is it advisable? And if so, how would I proceed?
Yeah, it's not advisable. The rootstock was selected maybe for its hardiness, possibly for its dwarfing effect, but the rootstock itself would not produce a good quality crop. So you typically don't want that to grow. You want basically the portion above the graft to basically produce the berries or the fruit. So you really don't want the rootstock to produce branches and growth.
And you don't want the original plant to be producing roots, because what that is it maybe counters the dwarfing effect. It may have been selected for that variety because of its tolerance to various soil conditions, disease resistance. a number of things, and winter hardiness. So,
when you plant a fruit tree that's been grafted or budded, you basically want to make sure that the graft union or bud union is just above ground level, and that's the correct way to plant it as far as depth.
And the other question is, the soil is very heavy here. How can I drain it well?
Fruit trees don't like heavy, poorly drained sites. I would try to find the best soil possible, but if you have, let's say, less than ideal soil, the main thing there would be to make sure you don't plant it too deep. So when you dig a hole, make the hole maybe three times the width of the soil ball, so make a really wide hole. But the actual hole depth should be a little bit less than the height of the soil ball, so that when you plant, there's no way it can sink deep into the soil. It's not going to be too deep. And then backfill with the original soil. Don't add anything to it. But at least for a short time, that backfill soil won't be as compacted.
Okay.
And so it does allow the roots to grow a little bit better in a difficult soil, because initially that soil will not be compacted like it is around it.
Oh, all right. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Shaker. Good luck with that. Yeah. We'll move on to Susan in Des Moines. Susan, welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. What's your question for Richard Geron and Linda Nave?
Thanks, and hello.
Hello.
I have a Washington hawthorn that is mature and is just a beautiful tree. And then about 3 years ago, it got some kind of crud that makes it get little galls, and then on the ends of the branches, there are little knobby, porcupiney little pods. The tree starts to bloom, and then before the fruit can develop, they get all blackened and gnarly also. Any ideas on that?
I would guess it's some type of rust, either cedar hawthorn rust or cedar quince rust.
Yeah, it does kind of look like, I've seen that rust on the cedar, so it does sort of resemble that, but smaller. Yeah.
And so that would be my guess. It's fairly common on some of the hawthorns. We also see it on apples and crab apples. So they're kind of related fungi. And those fungi love damp, cool, wet springs. That's what they really love. And so they tend to be more severe those years when we do have a damp, cool spring. We tend to see less of it in drier years. But it's hard to control. And at this point, it's too late to control for this year. What you might want to do is, if this reoccurs on the plant, maybe send a plant specimen to the plant diagnostic clinic here at Iowa State. And they can identify exactly what it is. Is it cedar quince rust, cedar hawthorn rust, exactly what is it? And then possibly suggest some control recommendations next spring. But if you have to spray, it'd be early next spring as the tree begins to leaf out. And more than one spray may be necessary.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, thanks so much.
Well, thanks for calling, Susan. Good luck with the hawthorn fruit. We appreciate the call. You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron and Linda Nave are here. Call in at 1-866-780-9100 for your questions. That's 1-866-780-9100. We'll go next to Ray in Mason City. Ray, welcome to the program. Well, I guess Ray is hopefully he'll call back. We'll move on to Shauna in Kinroth. Shauna, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Hi.
At a plant sale in Iowa City, I purchased two Sorbaria bushes, and they're just little tiny sprouts kind of potted up. And I really don't know anything about this plant, and so I went online and started looking it up, and what I saw was that it turns into a large bush that spreads suckers. And I'm a little concerned that I've purchased a monster.
What kind of shrub again? Sumac?
Sorbaria. S-O-R-B-A-R-I-A. And the variety is SEM. S-E-M.
I'm not familiar with that plant.
I'm not either.
So.
Stumped us.
Stumped. Can you describe it? What it looks
like?
Yeah.
It's a woody plant.
It is. It has a woody base and I would say sort of palmate leaves. When they come up, they have a salmon tinge. And then as they mature, they turn darker green. So just looking up online, and I believe it's in the Rose family.
Okay. Does that sound familiar? Not
well,
really. Okay.
I'm thinking that plant then might die back to the ground each winter. Does it do that? I'm trying to think.
They described it like that, yes.
Okay.
That it has a woody base, but that's about all that the rest
okay.
is herbaceous.
Right. So I think I have some idea what plant it is. And yes, I think it can be a little bit invasive.
Okay.
So the question is, do you really want it? Or if you do plant it, you might want to put it in a place where you can maybe try to contain it more
okay.
easily.
Okay. With plants that spread by suckers, if I were to build something, for example, I just put in a bed of ostrich ferns, and I know that they spread pretty rapidly, and so I surrounded them with just basically bricks buried in the ground. So with a plant that spreads by suckers, would that be a good strategy?
Well, when you have a plant that spreads by suckers, I think you may have to try multiple strategies mm-hmm. where you might use a shovel periodically, mm-hmm. you might use Roundup periodically. You do various things to kind of contain that plant. So mm-hmm. so oftentimes it's multiple strategies.
Okay.
The Roundup, the shovel, the spade, that type of thing.
Okay. You know, and it's a really pretty plant, so it may be worth the effort. So I just wanted to be sure I understood what I was getting into.
The other possibility would be to maybe put this in a pot, a big pot, and then sink the pot in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that would allow you to still have the plant, but maybe control some of that spreading that may occur.
Okay. Okay.
Good luck, Shauna. Sounds
an
interesting
much.
Project. Good. Yeah. Appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We'll go next to Phil in Urbana. Phil, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
I have two questions. The first is on asparagus. How long can it be harvested with multiple cuttings, or can it be harvested with multiple cuttings?
Okay, that's your first question. An established asparagus patch, typically you should discontinue harvesting around the middle of June. Now, this year people have been harvesting extremely early, and you might want to cut back maybe till about the first weekend in June and then quit harvesting, especially if you've gone several weeks with harvesting. But most years we say the middle of June should be your last harvest. What that does is it allows the plant to grow, produce ferny growth that then builds up the carbohydrates and the food reserves back into the crown, which then will sustain and produce your next year's crop.
Great. The other question is starting grapes from cuttings. Can it be done, or would I be better going with rootstock from a nursery?
You definitely can take cuttings. Typically what you want to do if you wanted to do that, you would go out like in March when the canes are basically dormant, and you would collect material from the previous year's growth, and you would bring them maybe inside and then make 12 to 15 inch cuttings, and then let's say tie them in a bundle, and then place them in a plastic bag along with some dampened peat moss, and then place them in the refrigerator. And then leave them in there until early April when the ground is workable. And in the refrigerator, they'll stay nice and dormant where they won't try to leaf out. And then in early April, take them out and put them directly in the ground vertically and place the vast majority of that cutting in the ground with just the uppermost bud sticking above the ground. And then keep the soil moist and hopefully some of those, and some should, go ahead and root and leaf out.
Okay. What about trying to do cuttings this time of year with them already leafing out?
It's real hard to do softwood cuttings. The hardwood cuttings are really much, much easier.
Okay. So I guess for this year I better find some rootstock.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thanks, Phil.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now. We'll go next to Leonard in Des Moines. Now, Leonard, welcome to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. What's your question for Richard Giron and Linda Nave? Hi.
Hi. I'm in the process of trying to grow blueberries. Fallon says I'm nuts. He might be right, but he said that before.
I don't think you're nuts.
I don't think so either.
The soil's been tested at 7.5 to 7.9 pH.
Mm-hmm.
I need to for it because I need to have it down around. If I got some, I got a 50-pound sack of ammonium sulfate at an egg supply store, and I was kind of wondering how much should I put in, and should I just tell it to the dirt?
I would not use ammonium sulfate because, I mean, aluminum sulfate, because the aluminum might be toxic to the blueberry plants. The best way to amend the soil when you're planting a few in the backyard garden is to buy some Canadian sphagnum peat or peat moss and incorporate that with the soil when you backfill, half soil, half peat, and that should effectively lower the pH.
We've got to go, but I hope that answers it for you, Leonard. Good luck with that. We're Talk of Iowa and Horticulture Day done for this day. We'll be back next week. Thanks to Richard Geron and Linda Knave. We had Talk of Iowa was produced by Dennis Reese. We had technical assistance from Christina Sarnella. Talk of Iowa's production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Julie Englander. Thanks for joining us.